and also he was Santa Claus. Batarang is a complicated guy.
But you and Kringle are the same person, I said.
Legally speaking, Kringle and Batarang are two entirely different people who simply happen to reside in the same body, he replied.
That's just a fiction, I said. A little game of protocol.
Little games of protocol are how one shows respect, especially to those with whom one does not get along famously well. It can be tedious, but generally is less trouble than a duel would be.
Mac set a couple of his home-brewed beers down on the bar. I rounded them up and returned to the table, putting both bottles out in the middle. Kringle chose one, nodded to the chair across from him, and I sat.
To start with, I'm going to assume you know everything I do, I said. His eyes wrinkled at the corners as he took a drink.
That seems wise.
I nodded and sipped my own.
Wow. Mac's beer is an excellent argument that there is a god, and that, furthermore, he wants us to be happy.
I savored it for a couple of seconds, and then wrenched my mind back to business. I want to float some thoughts at you and see if you think they're sound.
By all means.
First, I said, Nicodemus is after something powerful. I don't know what it is, but I do know that if I can get him to tell us what he's after, it's going to be a lie. He'd never let anyone know his true goal if he could help it.
I concur, Kringle said.
I nodded. He'll assemble a crew. Some of them will be his people, and some of them will be outside specialists, but I'm pretty sure at least one of them is going to be a plant. They'll look all independent, but they'll have one of those coins on them and one of the fallen whispering in their ears.
I would consider that a high probability, Kringle said.
Third, I said, he's going to betray me at some point along the line. He's proactive and obsessed with control, so he'll be the one who wants to stick the knife in first. He knows the limits Mab has placed on me, so he'll want to do it after I've gotten him to wherever he wants to go, but before we finish the job, to guarantee him the first blow.
Also sound reasoning, Kringle said.
Damn it, I said. I had hoped I was wrong about something. If I'm to follow Mab's rules, my options are limited.
Kringle's eyes went to the slender figure at the table by the door.
May I offer you a word of advice,
based purely upon my knowledge of the Queen's nature?
Sure.
Mab moves in mysterious ways, he said, looking back at me with a grin. Nasty, unexpected, devious, patient, and mysterious ways. I don't think she'd throw away a piece as valuable as you on a lost cause. Look for an opening, a weakness. It will be there.
Have you seen this guy in action? I asked. Nicodemus Arcleone is... he's better than me. Smart, dangerous, ruthless, and experienced. All by himself, he'd be bad enough. I've never even seen him go to his bench. All the other Denarians whip out their fallen buddies left and right, but Nicodemus, as far as I can tell, mostly uses his to chauffeur him around. I've got no idea what Anduril can do, because Nick has never had to fall back on him.
Perhaps that's because Nicodemus understands just as well as you do where true power comes from,
Kringle said.
I arched an eyebrow at that.
Knowledge, I said. I thought about it, putting pieces together.
Wait. You're telling me that he doesn't use Anduril in fights because Anduril isn't a fighter.
Any of the fallen are absolutely deadly in battle, Kringle said severely, even hampered as they are. But the Master of Shadows doesn't prefer to operate that way, no.
Nicodemus's control over the gang of superpowered lunatics was starting to make more sense now.
Master of Shadows. That's an old, old phrase for a spy master.
Exactly, Kringle said. Nicodemus knows very nearly as much as I do. Anduril has the potential to hear anything uttered within reach of any living being's shadow, and sometimes to look out from it and see.
My eyes widened, and I looked down at my own shadow on the table.
No, Kringle said. That's why Mab remains here, to secure this conversation against Anduril.
But you must exercise extreme discretion for the duration of this scenario. There are places Anduril cannot reach. Your friend Carpenter's home, for example,
or your island, now that you have awakened it. And the fallen must know to pay attention to a given shadow, or else it's all just a haze of background noise. But you can safely assume that Anduril will be listening very carefully to your shadow during this entire operation. Anything you say, Nicodemus will know. Even writing something down could be compromised.
Hell's bells, I said.
If that was the case, communicating with my friends would just get them set up for a trap. Man, no wonder Nicodemus was always a few steps ahead of everyone else. I'm going to have to play the cards really damn close to my chest, then.
If I were you, I'd hold them about 3 inches behind my sternum, just to be sure, Kringle said.
I swigged beer and drummed my fingers on the table.
Yeah, I said. Okay, good to know. But it's not enough. I need another advantage.
I never find having too many advantages any particular burden.
What would be perfect is a plant of my own, I said. Someone Nicodemus doesn't see coming.
But to work that angle, I'd have to know who he was getting together, someone he already planned to have in place.
Kringle took on the air of a professor prompting a stumbling protege.
How could you work with this theoretical person without the ability to speak with him, to coordinate your efforts?
Hide it in plain sight, I said, disguised as something else, code.
Interesting. Go on.
I said, he'd be taking his cues from me, so mostly he'd be the one asking me questions. Tell him to refer to me as Wizard just before he asks a question relating to the situation at hand. The first word of my response would be the answer. Then we could make the actual conversation sound like something else entirely. We play along until it's time for me to make my move. Then I use the phrase, game over, and we hit them.
Kringle took a pull of his beer.
Not bad. Not perfect, but then it never is. He set his bottle aside and reached down into the sack by his foot. He rummaged for a moment and then produced a large envelope, which he offered to me.
I regarded it carefully. Gifts have an awful lot of baggage attached to them among the Fae, and both Kringle and I were members of the Winter Court.
I didn't get you anything, I said.
He waved his other hand negligently.
Consider it a belated holiday gift, free of obligation. That island is a tough delivery.
Prove it, I said. Say ho, ho, ho.
Ho, 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 he replied genially.
I grinned and took the envelope. I opened it and found a photo and a brief description inside.
Who is this?
A covert operative, a mercenary, Kringle replied.
One of the best.
I've never heard of him.
He arched an eyebrow.
Because he's covert.
I bobbed my head a bit in admission of the point.
Why am I looking at his picture?
There are 4 operatives who could play one role Nicodemus needs filled in this venture, he said. 2 of them are currently under contract elsewhere, and the 3rd is presently detained. That leaves Nicodemus only 1 option. And I know he won't exercise it until the last possible moment, and he's not far away.
You think if I get to him first, I can hire him?
If I make the introduction and we establish your communication protocol under Mab's aegis, yes.
But if he's a mercenary, he can, by definition, be bought. What's to stop Nicodemus from outbidding me?
Kringle sat back in his seat at that, considering the question. Then he said, if you buy this man, he stays bought. It's who he is.
I arched an eyebrow. You're asking me to trust a stranger's professional integrity?
I wouldn't do that, Kringle said. I'm asking you to trust mine.
I exhaled slowly. I took a long pull of beer. Well, hell, I said. What's the world coming to if you can't trust Santa Claus?
I leaned forward, peering at the printed summary, and said,
so, let's meet with Goodman Gray.
Chapter 45. I hadn't quite finished the R sound in Game Over before Gray had crossed 40 feet of intervening space and was on top of Ursiel and the Janosqua. 1 second Gray was standing there, looking smug and anticipatory. The next, there was a blur in the air, and then a creature was clawing its way up Ursiel's back. It was about the size and vaguely the shape of a gorilla, but the head on its shoulders might have belonged to some kind of hideous werewolf-bulldog hybrid, and grotesquely elongated claws tipped its hands. Its weird golden eyes were grays. Before Ursiel could realize that he was under attack, the gray creature was astride its ursine back, fangs sinking into the huge hump of muscle there, oversized jaws locked into place. The huge bear thing reared up onto its hind legs, only for Gray to reach around to its head with gorilla-length arms and sink 9-inch claws like daggers into its eyes. Ursiel and the Janosqua let out an ear-tearing roar of agony. I whirled the heavy end of my staff toward Nicodemus and snarled, "Forzare!" The hailstone flew at him like a bullet, but though the shock of Gray's betrayal was still evident on his face, Nicodemus's superb reflexes were still in fine operating order, and he dropped into a lateral roll, dodging the missile. Michael shouted, "Harry!" and hauled me to one side, an instant before an orb of absolutely searing white heat appeared precisely where my head had been. The blast coming off of it was so intense that it singed the hair on that side of my head. I turned my head to see Asher and Lashiel lifting her other hand, preparing to hurl a second sphere at me.
"You get Nick," I panted. "Seems fair," Michael said.
In the background, Ursiel continued to roar and thrash. I couldn't see how it was going for Gray, but Ursiel crashed off of the stage and into a display featuring at least a dozen statues of various saints and holy figures, reducing them to rubble and scattering fabulously valuable gems in every direction. The second sphere came flying at me, and I countered by lifting my staff and shouting,
"Defendarius!"
A broad wall of force shimmered into being in front of me, and the sphere smashed against it and exploded into a cloud of flame that spread out along its length and breadth as if seeking a way around it. The heat was viciously intense, and enough of it would have burned through the shield, but it was a question of volume. Asher had struck at me with pinpoint precision and intensity. I'd countered her with raw power, using a shield big enough to spread the heat over a wide enough area to keep it from burning through. Asher let out a snarl of frustration and hurled another sphere. Her thinking was obvious. If she could keep pouring fire onto me and force me to hold up shield after shield against it, eventually she could either burn through it or exhaust my ability to keep holding it up. I'd have taken that fight against a lot of practitioners. There are relatively few wizards on the White Council who can stay with me in terms of pure magical horsepower. But while there are plenty of wizards who could wear themselves out pounding on my shields, I had a pretty solid intuition that Asher could keep throwing fire until I was a gasping heap on the ground, especially with Lashiel's knowledge and experience backing her up. Worse, Lashiel knew me inside and out. Or at least she had known me. So it was time to use a few tricks I'd developed since we'd parted ways. In the past, I'd worn rings designed to store a little excess kinetic energy every time I moved my arm. Then I could let loose the saved energy all in one place to pretty devastating effect when I really needed to do it. I hadn't had the resources I needed to make new rings, but I'd carved the same spell into my new wizard's staff. 77 times. It wasn't as handy as my layered rings had been. Instead of being broken into multiple units, the energy of the spell was all stored in one reservoir, so I only had one shot. But it was a doozy. So as another white-hot sphere splashed into flame against my shield, I whirled the butt end of the staff where the energy storage spells were carved toward Asher, focused my concentration on the shield, braced my feet, and shouted,
"Aretius!"
The staff bucked in my hands like a living thing and shoved my shoes several inches across the floor as the stored energy unleashed itself and drove into the rear of my shield. For a second, I worried about the staff shattering. I had never tried it with this much stored energy before, and there was always the chance that I had exceeded the design tolerance of the spell at some point. If I had, I would be the center of my own spectacular and splintery explosion. But my work was good, and the staff functioned perfectly. I held the structure of the shield together and let the energy from the staff drive it forward toward Asher, and suddenly a large, obdurate, and extremely solid, invisible wall was rushing at her like an oncoming freight train, shedding a trail of fire in its wake.
I had never lowered the shield, and my actions had been obscured by all the fire chewing away at it. So Asher recognized the danger a second too late, and that was where her inexperience showed. She might have real power and a gift with fire, but in a fight there's no time to think your way through spells and counterspells. Either you've done your homework or you haven't, and despite the advantage of having Lashiel in her corner, Asher wasn't ready for something like this. She was focused entirely on offense, not on protecting herself as well, and couldn't come up with a counter in time. The wall hit her with about the same force as an oncoming garbage truck, and blew her right out of the veil of purple mist that clung to her naked form. She flew back off the stage in a windmill of flailing limbs and crashed into a display of particularly fine ecclesiastical robes and garments, most of which burst into flame as the sheath of shimmering heat around her body brushed against them. As that happened, the light in the great vault changed. The fire in the hands of the two triple statues flared into large, dangerous-looking scarlet bonfires, painting everything in shades of sudden blood. I shot a glance up at the statues, and their mouths were moving. No voices were coming out, but the damn things were talking, and a raw instinct told me what had happened. The wanton destruction of part of the collection had set off some kind of alarm. And we were all standing, more or less, in one enormous prison for the shades of the dead. Michael and Nicodemus, meanwhile, were engaged in a furious exchange of blows. Amorakius glowed like a beacon, and its humming power filled the air. Nicodemus's shadow danced and threatened and obscured his form as he moved like some oily and poisonous liquid, sword flickering. But I had seen all of that before. I had never seen Michael going all out. Michael was a big guy, built broad and strong, and the contrast between him and Nicodemus was striking. There's an old truism in fighting that says a good big man will beat a good small man. The advantage gained from having superior height, reach, and greater physical mass and power is undeniable, and for the first time, I saw Michael using it all. Blow after blow rained down on Nicodemus, a furious attack, and the smaller man had no choice but to give way before the assault, driven step by step backward before the onslaught of the Knight of the Sword. His lighter blade managed to flick out once, then twice, but each time Michael twisted his body to catch the blow on his mail, trusting the armor Charity had forged for him to protect him, and it did. He kept coming forward, and none of his blows were aimed to wound or incapacitate. Amorakius swept down at Nicodemus's head, his throat, his belly, his heart, and any one of the strikes could have delivered a mortal wound. I flicked a glance toward where Asher was, for all I knew, on fire. I thought about going over and making sure she stayed down, and it made me feel sick enough that I decided I wasn't quite that far gone yet. Besides, dangerous as she was, she didn't hold a candle to Nicodemus. Michael had him on the ropes. This was our chance to put that monster away. Michael drove Nicodemus to the edge of the stage, until the Denarian had to twist with a snarl and dive off to the ground below. He tucked into a roll and came back up again, neat as an acrobat. And I tagged him with another hailstone before he could turn around and see it coming. I hadn't had time to get together as much ice as I'd used on the first two, but the hailstone that hit him was the size of a very large apple and moving considerably faster than a major league fastball. It didn't break when it hit. Nicodemus did. There was a wet thump of impact when it hit him in the left side, below the ribs, and he went up onto his toes in reaction, his body drawing to one side in a bow of pain. Then he staggered to one side and fell to a knee. Michael took two steps and leapt from the stage, sword grasped over his head, and brought it down on Nicodemus like a headsman's axe. No demonic power or fallen angel could save Nicodemus from that blow delivered by that man with that sword. Nick saved himself with pure nerve. As Amorakius swept down, Nicodemus, his face twisted in pain, lifted not his sword to block Michael's, but the Holy Grail. Michael let out a cry and twisted at the hips, pulling his blade to one side, and the blow swept past Nicodemus without touching him. Michael landed off balance and fell into a heavy roll. From the ground, Nicodemus thrust his slender blade at Michael's back, and sank the tip into the back of one of his thighs. Michael cried out in pain and came up to his feet heavily, favoring his wounded leg. Nicodemus rose, his dark eyes glittering, holding his left arm in close to his ribs, where the hailstone had hit him, favoring that side and moving stiffly. He turned to make sure he could see both me and Michael, and had visible trouble shifting his weight. He was hurt, but not nearly hurt enough to suit me. I called another hailstone to my staff. I raised it and aimed. Nicodemus lifted the grail again, a small smile on his face, as he held it between me and him as a hostage.
"Careful, Dresden," he said. "Are you willing to accept such a loss?"
"Yep," I said, and snarled.
"For Zare!"
Again sending another hailstone at him. Nicodemus's eyes widened, but he turned his body to shield the grail, and the hailstone struck him in the right shoulder blade. He let out another breathless cry, and then sudden blackness engulfed him, and a tide of shadows swept him away.
"Michael,"
I said, and hurried to my friend's side. Michael's eyes were busy, roaming left and right, looking for Nicodemus. He turned so that I could see the wound. It was a thrust, narrow but deep. There wasn't an inordinate amount of blood staining the leg of his jeans, and I didn't think it had gone into the artery.
"What happened there?" I asked. "Is he gone?"
I'm not sure," Michael said. "I've never seen him forced to run before."
"We should finish him."
"Agreed," Michael said.
"How? He just flew away."
"Give me a minute," I said, and felt myself baring my teeth in a grin.
"How does the leg feel?"
"I've had worse," Michael said, his voice strained. He shifted his weight, testing the leg, and made a hissing sound, but it supported his weight.
"Only a flesh wound."
"Yeah," I said. "'Tis but a scratch. Come on, you pansy." He blinked and looked at me.
"Pansy?"
"Oh," I said. "You weren't quoting the movie. Sorry."
"Movie? Holy Grail?"
"Nicodemus still has it," I sighed.
"Never mind."
From the other side of the amphitheater, there was a roar of collapsing stone, and I looked up in time to see a couple of sets of Corinthian columns falling to the accompaniment of Ursule's furious roars.
"So," Michael said, "to be clear, Gray is on our side."
"Yeah, I hired him before this started."
"But he killed Miss Valmont."
"No, he didn't," I said. "He lied to Nicodemus. She must be outside the vault somewhere waiting for us." Michael looked nonplussed.
"Oh, still, I don't care for the man."
"Hey, we're alive right now."
"True," he said. He drew a deep breath.
"And if he's kept faith with you, we should help him." Just then, Ursiel went up on its hind legs. Gray was still in that same monstrous form and still hanging on. The Janosqua's physical eyes were a bloody ruin, but Ursiel's glowing green orbs were furious and bright. The giant bear thing roared, a sound guaranteed to haunt my nightmares, should I live long enough to have any, and toppled over backward into another Corinthian column, attempting to smash Gray upon it. They went down with another huge crash and a spray of glittering gems. The sound of the impact was just freaking huge, the kind of noise you associate with the demolition of buildings, not with a brawl. I swallowed.
"Yeah, I guess we should..."
I paused as cold that had nothing to do with the movement of molecules crawled up my spine. I knew the feeling. I'd gotten the sensation before, when surrounded by hostile specters, back when I'd been mostly dead. It was a creepy, thoroughly nasty sensation that gathered around them like body heat. Which might not be a big deal in the physical world. Specters often could not interact with the material realm, or could do so only in specific and limited ways. But we weren't in the physical world. This was the Never Never, the underworld, and down here, spiritual forms would be every bit as real and as deadly as physical foes. Actually, much more so. In fact, given how many truly horrible monsters the various Greek heroes had slain, Hades might have a very, very nasty crew of guardians, indeed. The guy might, in fact, be the only one in the universe who could actually give the order, "Release the Kraken." But why would they be coming toward us? I mean, the guy had wished me well. Sure, he hadn't interfered, but... I looked up at the moving lips on the statues and winced.
Oh, crap.
What? Michael asked.
I think we've tripped some kind of automatic failsafe, I said. I think there are a load of dangerous spirits on their way toward us right now.
Then we should leave.
Post haste. Let's go get Gray and Boogie. We both turned and started moving toward Gray. Michael's best speed was a trot. But I hadn't gotten a dozen steps before a cry of pure fury rose up behind me.
Dresden!
Howled Lashiel through Asher's mouth. I looked back to see a form rising up from the small inferno, consuming the garment display, violet glowing eyes blazing. She planted her feet and seemed to inhale, and the flames all around her suddenly burned low and blazed the same ugly shade of purple as her eyes. The smell of brimstone filled the air.
Oh, crap, I breathed.
And then a lance of pure hellfire roared toward me. Chapter 46. There was no time to think. I ran on instinct. I couldn't shield a blast of flame infused with hellfire, the demonic version of soul fire. Hellfire enormously increased the destructive potential of magic. When Lashiel's shadow had been inside me, I'd used it. If I'd had my last shield bracelet, I might have parried most of it, but even that wouldn't have been enough to stop it cold. Couldn't counter it with winter. If I flung ice out to stop the fire, they would form steam, and hellfire would flow right into that and continue on its way. Same result, only I'd be steam cooked instead of roasted. Once or twice in my life I'd been able to open a way in front of me, fast enough to divert an incoming attack away from me, into the Never-Never, or out into somewhere else in the mortal world. But from here, in the secured vault, there was no way I was going to be able to open a way, not until I got back out beyond the first gate again. Fire was hard enough to deal with. Infuse it with hellfire, and it was almost unstoppable. So I didn't even try to stop it. Instead, I redirected it. As the strike hurtled toward me, I lifted my staff in my right hand, whirling it back and forth in front of my body in a figure-eight spin, and sent my will racing out through the staff, infused with soul fire, to counter the fallen angel's hellfire, shouting,
Ventus Sicklis!
A howling, whirling torrent of wind whipped out of my staff, spiraling tightly in on itself as the hellfire reached it. There was a flash of light, a thunderous detonation, and the sharp scent of ozone as the two diametrically opposed energies met and warred. The spinning vortex of wind caught the violet fire and bent it up toward the distant ceiling of the vault, slewing back and forth, a gushing geyser of unearthly flame. The effort to control that wind was tremendous. But even though the fire came within a few feet, the rush of air moving away from me prevented the thermal bloom from cooking me where I stood. My defense carried the entire power of the strike to the roof of the cavern, where it splashed and danced and rolled out in vast circular waves. It was actually damn beautiful. Asher let out a short snarl of frustration as the last of the strike flashed upward. I released the wind spell, but kept my staff spinning slowly, ready to counter a second time if I had to do it. Asher had plenty of anger still raging in her, and she drew on it to gather more fire into her hands.
Don't do it, Hannah!
I called.
You aren't going to beat me! You haven't got what you need!
You cocky son of a bitch, she said.
I've got everything I need to handle you, Warden! God, I was a fool to think you were any different than the rest of them.
Here's the difference, I said. Back down. Walk away. I'll let you. She actually let out a brief, incredulous laugh.
There is no end to the ego of the White Council, is there? She asked. You think you can pick and choose who is going to live and die? Decide all the rules that everyone else is going to live by?
The rules are there for a reason, Hannah, I said. And somewhere deep down, you know that.
But this isn't about the laws of magic or the White Council. It's about you and me and whether or not you walk out of this vault alive.
I tried to soften my voice to sound less frightened and angry.
That thing inside you is pushing your emotions, manipulating you. She can show you illusions so real that you can't tell the difference without resorting to your sight. Did she tell you that?
Asher stared at me without saying anything. I wasn't sure she'd heard me. Hell, if Lashiel was inside Asher's head, twisting her perceptions with illusion right now, she might not have heard me.
You can't have had her coin for long. A couple of weeks, a month, am I right?
Don't pretend you know me, she spat.
You're right, I said. I don't know you, but I know Lashiel. I had that coin once upon a time. I had her inside my head for years. I know what she's like, the way she can twist things.
She doesn't, Asher said. Not with me. She's given me power, knowledge. She's taught me more about magic in the last few weeks than any wizard did in my whole lifetime.
I shook my head. Fire magic is all about passion, Hannah. And I know you must have a lot of rage built up. But you've got to think your way past that. She hasn't made you stronger. She's just built up your anger to fuel your fire. Nothing comes free.
Asher let out a bitter laugh.
You're scared, Dresden. Admit it. I've got access to power that makes me dangerous, and you're afraid of what I can do.
And right there, she showed me the fundamental difference between us. I loved magic for its own sake. She didn't. The art can be a lot of work, and it can sometimes be tedious, and sometimes even painful. But at the end of the day, I love it. I love the focus of it, the discipline, the balance. I love working with the energy and exploring what can be done with it. I love the gathering tension of a spell and the almost painful clarity of focus required to concentrate that tension into an effect. I love the practice of it as well as the theory, the research, experimenting with new spells, teaching others about magic. I love laying down spells on my various pieces of magical gear. And most of all, I love it when I can use my talents to make a difference in the world, even when it's only a small one. Asher enjoyed blowing stuff up and burning things down. She was good at it, but she didn't love her talent for the miracle it was. She merely loved what she could do with it. And that had led her here. To a place where she had tremendous power, but not the right frame of mind to understand the consequences and permutations of using it. Or at least not where she needed it, deep in her bones. To wield power like she currently possessed, she needed to understand it on a level of gut instinct, having assimilated the art so entirely that the whole reality of using it came to her without conscious thought. It was why virtually every time she'd used magic in the past few days, it had been to destroy something or else to protect her own hide from the immediate consequences of her own power. It's why she hadn't put in the practice she needed to go up against someone with a broad range of skills. It was why she had focused exclusively on attacking me to the neglect of her own defenses a few moments before. It was why she'd said yes to the fallen angel who was now driving her emotions berserk. And it was also why she hadn't thought through the consequences of unleashing that much elemental destruction in a large but ultimately enclosed area. Asher had talent, but she hadn't had the training, the practice, or the mindset she needed to beat a pro.
I'm scared, I told her. I'm scared for you. You've had a bad road, Hannah, and I'm sorry as hell it's happened to you. Please, just walk. Please.
Her eyes narrowed, her face reddened, and she said, words clipped,
"Condescending bastard! Save your pity for yourself!"
And then, with a cry, she sent another lance of hellfire at me, redoubled in strength. Again, I caught it with a conjured cyclone infused with soulfire, though the effort was even more tremendous. Again, I sent it spiraling up toward the ceiling, but this time, I sent it all to one spot. Even before the last of the hellfire had smashed into the ceiling, I dropped to one knee, lifted my staff, and extended the strongest shield I could project, putting it between me and Asher. It was a calculated bit of distraction on my part, giving her something she wasn't psychologically equipped to ignore. She screamed at me, her eyes furious, gathering more fire in her hands, seeing only a passive target, weakened and fallen to one knee, one she could smash to bits with a third and final strike. But I saw Lashiel's glowing eyes widen in sudden dismay and understanding as the Fallen reached her own comprehension of consequences a few portions of a second too late to do any good. An instant later, several hundred tons of molten and red-hot rock, chewed from the earth above us by Asher's own hellfire-infused strike, came crashing down on top of her. The noise was terrible. The destruction was appalling. Glowing hot stones bounced from my shield and then began to pile up against it, pushing at me and physically forcing me back across the ground. The pileup shoved me a good 20 feet across the amphitheater floor, with Michael hobbling frantically along a couple of feet ahead of me, crouching to take advantage of the protection of my shield. After a few seconds, the falling stone became less violent and random, and I dropped my shield with a gasp of effort. I stayed right where I was, down on one knee and bent forward at the waist, struggling to catch my breath, exhausted from the efforts of the past few moments. The vault was spinning around and around, too. When had it started doing that? The air had gone thick with dust and heat and the smell of brimstone. Half of the freaking amphitheater had been buried by fallen stone. One of the enormous statues was covered to the thighs. And Hannah Asher and Lashiel were gone. A few last stones fell, clattering over the mess, bouncing. I noted dimly that their arches didn't look the way they should have. Gravity was indeed something heavier here than in the physical world. It was so heavy, in fact, that I thought I might just close my eyes and stay on the floor.
"Harry," Michael breathed. "Sorry about that, Hannah," I heard myself mutter. "I'm sorry."
Michael put his hand on my shoulder. "Harry, are you all right?" I shook my head and gestured weakly at the fallen rock with one hand.
"Hell's bells, Michael. That wasn't even a fight. It was just murder. She wasn't a monster. She just made a bad call. She let that thing inside her and just pushed her buttons. Drove her."
"It's what they do," Michael said quietly.
"Could have been me over there. There but for the grace of God goes Harry Dresden."
Michael limped around to stand in front of me, slapped me lightly on the cheek, and said,
"We don't have time for this. Reflect later. We'll talk about it later. Get up."
The blow didn't hurt, but it did startle me a little and made me shake my head. The immediate exhaustion of slinging that much power around began to fade, and I shrugged off the lethargy that went with it. The ugly, prickling cold was still coming closer.
"Harry," Michael said, "are you with me?"
"Headache," I muttered.
And then I realized what that meant. Mab's earring burned like a tiny frozen star in my ear, and my head was beginning to pound anyway. I was running out of time.
And unless I could get everyone back to the first gate and open the way back to Chicago, it was running out for everyone else as well. I planted my staff and pushed myself to my feet. I felt creaky and heavy and tired, and I couldn't afford to let that matter. Everything snapped back into focus, and I swiped at something hot and wet in my eyes.
"Okay," I said. "Okay. Let's get gray and get the hell out of here."
Just then, something that looked vague and lean and had huge bat-like wings streaked through the air toward us from the far side of the amphitheater. One of its wings faltered, and it tumbled out of the air, hit the marble floor, and started bouncing. The form rolled several times, and when it stopped, Gray was lying there, looking dazed. The lower half of his face, as well as his hands and forearms, were soaked with scarlet blood.
"Michael," I said.
We moved together, getting Gray onto his feet between us, and starting back toward the entrance to the vault, skirting the hellish heat coming off of the rubble.
"Gray," I said, "what happened?"
"He got smart and shifted down," Gray said. "My jaws slipped, but something got in his eyes, and I disengaged before he could reverse the hold on me."
From somewhere behind us came the Janoskwa's furious roar and the crash of another column falling.
Then another roar, pained, that grew deeper in register as the Janosqua assumed Ursule's demon form again and rose up onto his hind legs, coming into sight of us. Doing so put his head damn near 20 feet off the ground, and though we were most of the way up the amphitheater stairs, Ursule's glowing eyes and the Janosqua's ruined and bloody eye sockets were level with my own. The demon bear opened its jaws and roared in fury.
"He looks pissed," I squeaked.
"Certainly hope so," Gray said, slurring the words a little. He was only barely supporting his own weight, and his eyes still looked vague. "Give me a sec. Be fine."
Ursule dropped back down to all sixes and started toward us. He was limping on the leg Michael had cut, but it wasn't just flopping loosely the way it should have been. "Hell's bells," he recovered fast.
"Belmont," I said to Gray, "where is she?"
"Send her back to the first gate," Gray said, "with your magic toys.
"That's it," I said to Michael. "You're hurt." Gray scrambled. "Get him back to the first gate and do it as fast as you can." Michael clenched his jaws. "You can't fight Ursule alone, Harry. You can't win." "Don't need to fight him," I said. "Just need to buy you two some time to get clear. Trust me, I'll be right behind you." Michael closed his eyes for a second, and then gave me a quick nod and shouldered Gray's weight more thoroughly.
"God be with you, my friend."
"I'll take whatever help I can get," I said, and stopped at the top of the amphitheater stairs, while Michael half-carried Gray back out the way we'd come. My head pounded. I shook the sheathed knife out of my sleeve and dropped it into the duster pocket with my overgrown revolver, then checked the shroud to make sure it was secure. From the far rear of the vault, I heard something let out an eerily, windy-sounding cry, and the sensation of cold around me grew more and more intense, gaining an element of irrational, psychic terror to go with it. An instant later, other cries echoed the first, and the sensation of unthinking panic swelled. My heart sped up to a frantic pace, and my limbs felt shaky and weak. The shades were coming. Ursule let out another furious roar, and then a 20-foot horned bear the size of a main battle tank broke into a lumbering run as it came up the stairs toward me, fangs bared, intent upon mayhem. And rather than turning to flee like a sane person, I brandished my staff in one hand, flew him the bird with the other, and screamed,
"Hey, Yogi! Here I am! Come get some!"
Chapter 47. Ursule was too big to fight. Look, people go on and on about how size isn't everything and how the bigger they are, the harder they fall. But the people who say that probably haven't ever faced down a charging demon bear so big it should have been on a drive-in movie screen. As a defensive adaptation, sheer size is a winner. It's a fact. Ask an elephant. But as a hunting adaptation, size is only good when the things you're hunting are also enormously huge. Successful predators aren't necessarily bigger than the things they take down. They're better armed and just big enough to get the job done if they do it right. Too much bulk and nimble prey can escape, leaving the hunter less able to handle a broad range of targets. Gray had done something brilliant in blinding the Janosqua. He'd forced it to rely upon Ursule's eyes. That meant, apparently, that he had to stay in that giant bear form to do it. If the Janosqua had been able to pursue me in his natural form, he would have caught me and torn me apart in short order. I'd seen him move. The bear might have been an irresistible mass of muscle, claws, and fangs, but I'd had a little experience with very, very large creatures on the move, and I'd learned one important fact about them. They didn't corner well. Ursule closed in and went into a little bounce, a motion as close to a pounce as something that size could manage, and I darted to one side. Harry Dresden, wizard, might have bought the farm right there, but Sir Harry, the winter knight, dodged the smashing paws and snapping jaws by a tiny margin, hopped back several yards, and shouted,
"Ole, Toro!"
Ursule roared again, but its head swung around toward the retreating forms of Michael and Gray. Ursule was no tactical genius from what I'd seen of it, but both it and the Janosqua were predators, and Michael and Gray were wounded and vulnerable.
It could catch them and dispatch them easily, and then hunt me down at its leisure like a cat dealing with so many troublesome mice. So I lifted my staff, pointed it at the demon bear, and shouted, "Fuego!" The blast of fire I sent at him wasn't much. I didn't feel like passing out from exhaustion at the moment, and both the Junosqua and Ursiel had displayed a troublesome resistance to my magic. That wasn't the point. The mini-blast of flame struck the bear in the side of the nose, and while it didn't sear the flesh, it singed some hairs, and I bet it stung like hell. The bear's head whipped back toward me, and it rolled a step forward. Then the glowing eyes brightened, and it swung again toward the wounded men, now leaving the vault. The conflict of wills going on between the Junosqua and the fallen angel was all but visible.
"Jeez," I drawled, in the most annoying tone I possibly could. "You suck, Jen. I'll bet you anything River Shoulders wouldn't be all torn and conflicted right now."
That got it done. The great bear whirled back to me and lunged into instant savage motion, and again I skittered out of the way a couple of inches ahead of being ground into paste. I darted a few more yards to one side, putting one of the displays between us. It didn't bother to go around, it just crashed straight through, spraying gold and jewels everywhere, and I damn near got my head redecorated with a falling marble column. I slipped, recovered my footing, and kept moving, forcing the huge bear to keep turning laterally if it wanted to pursue me. It went like that for a subjective century and a half, and maybe 30 objective seconds. Several suits of armor were crushed and scattered when a flashing, enormous paw shattered the marble column holding up the roof of their display area. Half a dozen pieces of art that might have been Fabergé eggs in delicate golden cages were smashed flat when a sledgehammer blow missed me by an inch. At one point, I picked up a cut diamond the size of my fist and screamed, "Get rocked!" and flung it at Ursiel's nose before darting behind another exhibit, this one of rare, sacred texts, featuring half a dozen Gutenberg Bibles as the centerpiece. And then something scary happened. The roaring stopped. I froze in place instantly. Everything got quiet, except for the rushing sound of the flames in the hands of the giant statues, and a rising tide of moaning, terrifying wails coming steadily and unnervingly closer from the rear of the vault. Something made a metallic clinking sound, like maybe the sound a great big foot would make as its blind owner accidentally kicked a fallen gem into something made of precious metal. Oh, crap. I looked around and realized that there was rubble scattered over every inch of floor around me for 50 feet in every direction. I had forgotten that Ursiel's bestial nature was not the only one I had to deal with. The Junosqua's intellect had been at work behind it, too, and I'd been had. The Junosqua had been trying to catch and kill me, sure, but he had also been intentionally covering the floor around us with detritus so that there would be no way in hell I could move without making noise. Then he wouldn't need eyes to catch me and kill me.
"Little wizard," rumbled the Junosqua's voice.
It had a weirdly modulated quality to it. It was coming from behind a veil, maybe, and I couldn't isolate the direction of its origin.
"Going to twist your head off, your skinny neck. Going to enjoy it."
I had some material I could have thrown back at him, but I didn't dare speak. I would have sounded terrified anyway. The howls and the eerie presence of the shades continued to grow closer and more intense, and my heart was pounding hard enough to shake my chest. I held my feet perfectly still and tried to turn my head without rustling my clothing at all, scanning for the Junosqua. I couldn't see him, but his voice was close. I knew I would only get one chance to move. If I didn't do it right, he would run me down and do exactly what he said he'd do, and a weird, little fluttery sensation went slithering through my neck at the thought of it. I had to know where he was.
"Take off your head like a cap, little wizard,"
the Junosqua rumbled, pausing to listen between each sentence.
"Drink your blood like a bottle of pop."
That image was so vivid that I nearly let out a nervous giggle. I caught it just in time and closed my eyes, listening as hard as I could.
I could hear small, faint sounds, crunching rubble, weight shifting atop a pile of spilling gems. But it all had the same distorted tone as the Janoskwa's voice, impossible to localize. Stop behaving like a prey animal, Harry, and use your brain. Right. The Janoskwa couldn't hear me and couldn't know exactly where I was, but sooner or later, if I held still, he'd find me. If I muttered the word to a spell to veil my own movement, he'd hear that, too. My pounding head was already under enough pressure that I didn't dare try to use magic without a verbal utterance. I could do it, but the psychic feedback was devastating, and the last thing I needed was to slip up and take myself out for him. Even using my magical senses might give me away. The Janoskwa was something of a practitioner himself, and might well be able to feel me extending my aura to detect energy around me. The shades came closer, and the air in the vault had grown uncomfortably warm with the heat from the melted rock. The heated air around it was rising, and that updraft was what was fanning the fires in the hands of the statues, making them growl quietly. Draft. Air brushed across the fine hairs on the back of my hand, flowing gently past me from the exterior of the vault and in toward the hot stone, more or less in the center of the huge chamber. Don't think like a human, Harry. Think like a predator. Ignore sight. Forget hearing. Where would a predator go when stalking his prey? Downwind. The Janoskwa would be moving downwind of me, locating me through my scent. It wasn't the same as knowing where he was, but for my purposes, it was close enough. Assuming, of course, that my reasoning was correct. If it wasn't, I was about to trap myself with him and become Harry Dresden, human beverage. I didn't have much energy left in me for spells, but I had to chance it. So I called upon Winter, focused my will through my staff, and shouted,
Glassi Valare!
Icy cold rolled out of the staff and solidified into a wall of ice maybe 20 feet long and a foot thick, curved slightly toward me. I prayed that the Janoskwa was on the other side of it, turned and sprinted, my life depending upon it. I hadn't gone 20 feet when something hit the wall and shattered it with a crash. I flashed a quick look back over my shoulder to see the Janoskwa as a large, humanoid blur behind a veil that had faltered as tiny flecks of ice landed on the Janoskwa and melted to water. The veil shimmered and fell, and he didn't bother trying to restore it. He recovered his balance after almost a whole half second and came after me, coming along the ground in a rush, using his huge arms as well as his legs to run. If Michael hadn't lamed him, the Janoskwa could have claimed his 5-cent deposit for my corpse. But though he was on the mend, he still wasn't moving at full speed, and I was able to stay a couple of steps ahead of him. His stench filled my nose, and his huge breathing was terrifying as he came along behind me, tracking me by the frantic sound of my running feet and labored breath. I couldn't fight this guy, but that didn't mean that I couldn't kill him. We flew out of the vault and out past the gate of blood, and I poured it on, committing all of my reserves to the effort. I called light to my staff as I sprinted down the tunnel that emerged at the gate of ice, and as I went by it, I drew upon the power of the winter mantle to slam the iron lever back up to the on position and snap it off at the base in the same savage motion. And then I plunged out into the 200-yard-long killing field as the house-sized blocks of ice began to fall and shatter and slide and flip and smash together like some kind of enormous, demented garbage disposal unit.
Parkour!
I screamed, dropping to a slide that took me just under a horizontally flying block of ice as big as a freight car, then popping back up to keep running.
Parkour!
I shouted again, bounding up onto a small block and diving over several more, ducking and weaving between them, the Janoskwa hot on my tail, casting frantically quick glances back at him, watching him close the distance inch by inch, his huge body moving with an utterly unfair amount of agility as he handled the obstacles better than I could have, even without his eyes. And then the cold started to get to him. It wasn't much at first. He lost a step on me. But then, in the next row of grinders, one of them clipped his monstrous shoulder. He recovered his balance and kept moving, and we were nearly through the field when I played dirty.
I jumped over a pair of low grinders and turned in midair just enough to point a finger back at the ground behind me and snap,
Infriga!
I didn't use a lot of power, barely a whisper, really, just enough to coat a 10-foot patch of cavern floor with smooth winter ice. And his foot slipped. It wasn't a big slip, but his cold, dulled reflexes weren't up to catching him, and his balance wavered. Not much. He was, after all, running on all fours, but enough. It staggered him as he came after me, slowing his pace again. Suddenly, there was a 10-foot wall of grinders in front of me, each individual block spinning and smashing and flipping at unpredictable intervals, and I let out a scream and leapt over it completely, high-jump style. My shoulders brushed the top of the wall, treating me to a dandy view of another house-sized block falling straight at me from the darkness overhead, and then I bounced off the top of the wall and tumbled into the clear. The Janosqua grabbed the top of the wall and vaulted it easily, his huge, hairy form moving with effortless power. He'd somehow anticipated its presence. He must have heard my shout and jump, and maybe the way I'd gone over it at the top. Or maybe Ursiel was helping him through his sightless chase, the way Lashiel had once helped guide me in total darkness. But neither the Janosqua nor the fallen angel sensed what was plummeting soundlessly toward them. A block of ice the size of a building came down like the hammer of God Almighty and crushed the Janosqua like a beer can. I rolled to a stop and flopped on the stone cavern floor, utterly exhausted, breathing like a steam engine. But I had enough energy to turn my head to the gruesome remains being tossed about like a rag doll among the last row of grinders.
Parkour, I panted. Bitch.
And then I just breathed for a minute. Footsteps approached a moment later, and I felt hands hauling me up. Michael had sheathed Amorakius again, and he steadied me as I rose. Gray stood and watched the grinders grind for a moment before he shook his head and said,
Yuck.
Right? I said. Anna Valmont shuddered, her face pale, and turned to me.
Are you all right, Harry?
Nothing 2 months of sleep in a good bed won't cure, I said. A chorus of moaning wails suddenly came toward us, as though the shades that had begun flooding the vault had reached some kind of critical mass and were now surging forward. I still hadn't seen them, and I didn't want to see them. I had this vague image of the scrubbing bubbles of undeadness from that Lord of the Rings movie in my brain, and I was sure that would serve fine for imagining the threat drawing quickly nearer.
What was that? Anna asked.
Bouncers, I said. We don't want to be around when they get here. Let's get clear of the first gate, people. And we did, hurrying down the tunnel to the location of the original way. I took a deep breath and steadied myself for what I hoped would be the last serious effort of the day. Michael, I said.
Yes?
I figure Nicodemus had Lashiel and Asher as his backup way home, I said. Asher had been throwing hellfire around. With a couple of weeks' training from a good teacher, say a fallen angel, who could provide her with images and communicate directly in thought, she might have enough talent to learn how to manage a way. But probably not from inside several hundred tons of molten rock. Maybe the Janosqua could have done it, but they're out. That leaves one way for him to get back. Michael grunted and drew his sword, and Gray frowned and looked warier than he had a moment before.
We're not in much shape for a fight, Harry, Michael said.
Neither is he, I said. Eyes open. Get through the way as quick as we can, and I'll zip it closed behind us. Nick can find his own way home.
Then I focused my will, drew a line in the air with my staff, and said,
Aperturum.
Once more a line of light split the air and widened, and from where I stood, I could see the inside of the vault back at Marcone's bank. I leaned heavily on my staff, and felt fairly proud of myself for not falling over and going to sleep right there.
Michael, I said, go.
Michael drew his sword and went through first, his eyes wary for any danger.
Anna, I said.
Valmont went through, still carrying her backpack, I noted. It was one of the identical ones which Nicodemus had provided for everyone and which I had ignored. Gray had used a duplicate as his decoy back at the amphitheater.
My God, Gray said, looking at me. You didn't get any loot? How the hell are you going to pay me?
Think of something, I said.
Gray smirked. I know we're in a hurry, but there's something you need to realize.
What?
No one got Binder's share, he said. We're all worn pretty ragged, and he's got an army of demons he can jump us with.
Food for thought.